Hey gang, Kevin Strange here.
Jamie Daniels.
Listen, we're going to be radically changing the way the Patreon works in a few months, but for now, you come in at the $1 level, and you get access to all of my audiobooks, right?
Right.
You get Jorek and the Shaugus Steel, Jorek and the Swamp Phantoms of Vic. You get Cotton Candy.
McHumans. Humans Under the Bed.
You get
Computer Face.
And you get Holy Matrimony. These are hours and hours and hours of audiobooks. As if that wasn't enough, only for $1, and not a dollar each. It's a dollar a month. A dollar a month gets you access to all of that, plus the Overrun episodes of our sister podcast, Watching with Strangers. We do a weekly Overrun podcast every single week. You get a new episode of that show. It's ridiculous not to jump in, help us, support the podcast. We're trying to get 20 patrons in the month of May. And I promise you, in the next couple months, it's going to be worth it. We're going to convert this over. It's going to be a book club, gang. It's going to have merch. I'm going to be giving away t-shirts and buttons and stickers and novels, exclusive novellas and books from Kevin Strange. Just get in now. Get these cool podcasts and audiobooks and stick around because it's going to get only better.
Right? Travis is my sister.
All right, there you go. Right. Ah, but sir, all pilgrims share a deep love of life, especially their own. Is that good?
Yeah.
Oh, hey, gang. Welcome back to another episode of Watching with the Strangers. How you doing, Travis?
Good. How are you doing, Kevin?
I am well.
Good, good, good.
How did we fall back into the sword and sorcery
genre so quickly? It just happened. I think we both wanted to do this film, but this was actually your pick this round of 10, so I think you were beast happy.
I was men in loincloths with shaved, chiseled...
I think you're doing a little happy dance, just want to get this one in.
No, I love this movie. Is this my favorite sword and sorcery movie?
Over Legend?
Is Legend a sword and sorcery?
That's a fantasy. No, I guess, yeah, okay, so, well...
Legend is hardcore fantasy.
It's hardcore fantasy, so this is, yeah, we'll call it sword and sorcery, so... I don't know. I wouldn't blame you for putting it at number one.
Conan and Red Sonja are hard to fuck with.
They are. They're better. They have a higher production value and they're fun.
This movie is so full of monsters.
I've loved this movie for so long.
It's so full of
monsters. I can honestly say I've seen this movie more times than Red Sonja or either of the Conan movies.
So many monsters and cultists and child sacrifices and just bizarre movies.
One of the few movies that after seeing it gave me nightmares as a kid.
Did it?
Well, it was the vampire hawk people things.
I can't wait to get into those because you're gonna have to explain a lot of stuff to me.
Oh yeah.
You're gonna have to explain a lot of stuff to me about those guys.
Well, but I can.
What movie are we talking about this week?
We're talking about the 1982 Don Coscarelli masterpiece, and I use the word loosely, The Beastmaster.
Now, Don Coscarelli.
Yes, sir.
He made your favorite movie of all time, didn't he?
Oh, he's one of my favorite filmmakers of all time.
Bubba Hotep, right?
Well, that's not my favorite movie of all time, but I do love it. Yeah. I mean, Phantasm is a great film.
You and I actually went to see the 4K restoration.
That was a beautiful restoration.
By J.J. Abrams. And it always, like when I watch Phantasm again, after I haven't watched it in a long time, I always forget how many scenes are shot against a stark black background. The only thing lit is the vehicle and the character.
Oh, absolutely.
And how utterly dreamlike that movie is. Only then at the end to turn out to be a dream.
And even though it was the first movie, it was still a relatively low budget film and it looked so great. It was still under $1 million budget. Beastmaster was actually his first $1 million plus budget that he did. It's the fourth film.
You had to pay for a lot of those helicopter shots.
Yeah, especially one the end.
Those guys today, though, man, have you seen a lot of footage on YouTube for civilian drones? Uh-uh. Drones have the most beautiful
aerial shots. Oh, I can imagine. Real smooth, yeah.
Oh, my. Well, the thing is, man, since they use, like, GPS navigation, mm-hmm. you can fucking throw a drone up, you know, whatever, three stories, and then hover it right mm-hmm. there, and it doesn't move. Stay. It's like
that I'm a big fan of American football or anything, but just watch a football game, a pro football game, an NFL game, and you get a real good sense of how beautiful the footage looks through these drone cameras, because it's like, holy crap. I mean, it's once they get a clearer, a more free, like right now it's kind of tied up in the legal stuff, or not the legal stuff, but you know, the FAA kind of freaking out. They don't want too many of these running wild around,
right.
You know, all that stuff. But I don't know, when indie filmmakers have a easier access to them, I think it's going to blow up. I think it's going to change the game again.
I watch YouTubers and they have beautiful aerial shots. But watching movies like this, because Sword and Sorcery had a lot of aerial.
Oh yeah, just shots to get the scope
of mountains and yeah,
beautiful Southern California, which is where this was shot.
And going back and watching Beastmaster today, I was like, man, that shot was a fucking bitch compared to, because not only did they have to mount, they had to mount them on the helicopters in such a way that they didn't vibrate while they were taking the shot.
If I don't know if you've never noticed it, but if you look real closely, I'm told you can see it. But the tiger, when he's up there, he's chained up. Because he's up there freaking out because of the helicopter.
No shit. Yeah, that's another thing, watching all the animals in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
It's, again, throws back to Willow, where I was talking about, like, trying to shoot around all that stuff. I don't think that Don Coscarelli did quite as good of a job shooting around these animals as,
well, there's
as
a lot behind
Ron
that too.
Howard did shooting around the little people in Willow.
Well, you know, there's no rule about working with little people, you know. But the two primary rules in Hollywood is don't work with kids and don't work with animals.
Right.
What does Don Coscarelli do? He has a couple kids and a whole lot of animals in this movie on less than $1 million budget.
We got to talk about those kids too, because I got a lot of questions. I got a lot of questions in general about this movie.
Kevin, you always have questions.
What? We watch some weird movies.
Yeah, we do.
So this is not a 1986 movie.
No, it's a 1982 movie.
But it is a 1980s movie.
Yes.
And the sort of the nature of films like this, mm-hmm. it actually took me by surprise that it was so early, that it was mm-hmm. an 82 film. Mm-hmm. Because there's no, when you do a sword and sorcery movie or fantasy movie, there's no frame of reference to mm-hmm. cars or
right.
or
at least you hope not.
Well, you know, there's a goof section. You don't see the vehicles. There's no, you don't see costume like the
outfits. Unless it's a Sam Raimi movie, and then he finds some way to work in his old car.
You don't see the outfits that date it. They don't use the parlance of the times that would date it. Mm-hmm. They don't use music that dates it. So to me, I'm watching this, and it's 82. This thing looks like it could have been all the way up to about 90.
Yeah, early 90s. Yeah.
So maybe that's in fate. Maybe that's in his.
Well, fate. Clothing wise, there's not much clothing to begin with. I mean, poor Mark Singer's running around on a loincloth the whole movie.
It's a lot of very partially naked people in this movie.
And naked people.
But yeah, the maybe that's a mark in favor of Coscarelli. I'm going to pronounce this as many different ways as I can. that. It doesn't look dated. It doesn't look like an early 80s movie.
No.
Now looking back, 82, some of those monster effects were actually really cool for an 80s movie.
I always really enjoyed the... I always thought, as simple as they were, I just thought they were really cool. The... I call them Beastmen, but that's not what they were.
The Berserkers?
The Berserkers, those were just cool looking. We'll get back to the Hawk people. That'll be a whole thing on some once we get to them.
I liked those Berserkers so much that I actually took G.I. Joes.
Customize them?
I took thick medical tape mm-hmm. that I had laying around my house for some reason when I was a little kid. Mm-hmm. And I wrapped up a G.I. Joe's hands and head. And then I cut out and with a black marker, mm-hmm. I actually turned it all black and everything and tried to make Berserkers. Those things were...
Tough part would get the eyes to glow.
Yeah,
you know,
well, not
now. Not now. It would be too hard. It reminded me of when there was that scene when they were talking about where they were showing what they did to make them the berserker into the berserker. They were just imprisoned slaves that they turned into berserkers. Mm-hmm. It reminded me of Wrath of Khan. Yeah. You know, because they got that little glow-in-the-dark leech that they put in his ear and it drives him mad.
Yeah.
You know?
Very cool stuff. Yeah, and that's the kind of body horror stuff mm-hmm. that I think Beastmaster uses mm-hmm. that a lot of these sword and sorcery movies don't use.
Right. Well, it's a very Coscarelli touch.
And that's why I say, is this my favorite sword and sorcery movie? Question mark? Because yeah. it's got a lot of elements that are...
Maybe we'll know by the end of the episode.
It's got a lot of elements that speak to me personally, yeah. but it's not quite as epic as like Conan.
Right.
Even though it's got a sweeping epic score, and it's got the aerial shots, and it's got, it's just kind of a simple movie.
Right.
It's not.
But
as
it's got elements to it that never really show up in any of the other relatively well known sword and sorcery films. Or they all kind of stay within the same safe zone. Whereas he took this
all with like ugly witches with like really
scantily really clad, busty. Like, otherwise attractive witches just with, like, the deformed pig heads.
The ultimate butterfaces.
Right.
And the magic is all really messy.
Yeah.
Like, when they have the eye and when yeah. they when the pilgrim
on the eye ring?
Pokes out the eye ring and
how
it actually
cool is that?
It actually pokes out one of the witch's eyes. Yeah. And, like,
well, that's why one of them doesn't have an eye.
Because that's her eye.
You don't realize it at first until you connect the two, yeah.
Then there's when the tiger was killing the cultist that was wearing yeah. the ring, his hand comes up through their cauldron.
Yep.
It's really messy magic, and that's the kind of stuff that I'm super drawn to in this kind of stuff is like the cultists, the witches, what the fuck at the beginning of the movie when Rip Torn's character is like confronted by the king, mm-hmm. his guy's like. Throw hooks into the ceiling and hang themselves?
Because they're conveying the sense that this is a full-on cult. We don't give a fuck. We are committed.
But what
to
is
where
the
they
point?
Will literally just kill themselves at the snap of a finger from Max, is his name, Rip Torn's character. which I got a little bit of a story about him, too.
But what was the point? The point was there's a lot of moments in this movie. Mm-hmm. Don Coscarelli wants to show us something. Mm-hmm. That leaves me going, what the fuck?
There's a lot
now,
of,
I get it. Well, story-wise, I understand yeah. he needs to convey that this is a cult.
Right.
And he doesn't want to do it with a lot of dialogue.
Right.
But really, why kill your guys?
Well, I think the message that Mayox is trying to send is... Because remember, King Zed, the guy he's talking to, who's the guy that banishes him, right? He threatens to kill him.
So
and,
in response,
so,
he kills
so
his
So he
guys.
Just gives a glance to his two guys who just... Without hesitation, throw their little spiked hanging chains up and hang themselves to death, as just to send the message: you can try, but guess what? None of my men are going to let you kill me. Every one of them will die before me before they'll let you get to me.
But he killed his guy, so there was no one left.
But
to
he was
send,
no, not right there. Those are just the two guys that were with him. But I think
that's
it,
where I'm coming.
But it made King
from.
Zed piss his pants. You can see the look on his face. He's like, "What the?" He had a "what the fuck"
did.
Moment right
it
there.
It certainly
on screen.
Did. But to me, I'm thinking, okay, you got two guards. Uh-huh. They want to imprison you, possibly kill you.
Right.
Oh yeah, motherfucker! I'll have my guards kill themselves, and then I'm defenseless.
Well, he had the witch. He had a witch or two in there with him too.
Did
he? I thought
I don't
so.
Remember.
Anyway. They're pretty wicked too.
I watched.
They ended up pulling some Evil Dead Deadite moves in this movie.
Yeah,
crawling
up
the wall and shit.
So cool, man. So cool. I watched these movies. Like, by the way, in the audience, if you guys are strangers, mm-hmm. if you're wondering uh-huh. why I can't ever remember anything, I literally watch these movies as late in the game as I can, so I can remember as much as possible. This
way
is
how, the encyclopedia.
This
right?
is how bad my memory is. When we're talking about stuff and I can't remember it, keep in mind I watched this movie 2 hours ago.
Kevin has a goldfish memory. I do too. It just it's temperamental.
I've got, there's so much in there; it just falls
oh, yeah.
out. New
yeah.
things, new things.
I'm
just
watching
fall out.
Just info just oozing out of his ears right now as we speak.
Exactly.
It's kind of nasty, actually.
So let's get into Don Coscarelli.
Don Coscarelli is, I think, outside of the genre, which. To call Don Coscarelli a genre filmmaker is kind of apropos because he is a genre filmmaker, but he didn't stick to one genre. But outside of genre fans, Don Coscarelli, I think, is one of the most underappreciated filmmakers there is out there right now.
He doesn't have a lot of credits, but he's made...
He has a fair number of credits. I mean, you have a lot of great filmmakers that may not make a movie every year or two, but they do good work.
It seems like the ones we deal with are mostly really prolific.
Yeah.
Really, really prolific.
He's given us in the films that he's made.
I don't disagree with Phantasm,
which is a game changer.
I don't disagree with that.
And then I actually enjoy Phantasm 2 more. I think it's a better made film, but Phantasm was... was a whole nother... That was something we'd never seen before.
I have a rule.
What's that?
If a movie has a homemade flamethrower in it to fight monsters...
Yeah.
I love it.
Oh, and then you have to give him credit for the quadruple barreled sawed-off shotgun.
Reggie's not getting any argument out of me. I absolutely think Phantasm 2.
I mean, come on, shiny chrome spheres that fly around and have like their Swiss Army killing chrome spheres, you know.
And in another completely nonsensical but very cool looking,
very cool,
very Don Coscarelli kind of thing is when the spheres lodge into your forehead and they start sucking your
they got the drill that comes out and they drill a hole in your skull and then they suck your juices out.
Spray it all over the floor.
Not the bad. So just getting you ready because then the tall man's gonna come along, pick you up, and put the yellow goo. That preps you, I guess, for being a dwarf from hell.
Shrunken down into a dwarf. Bizarre.
Or what I call one of those things from Jawa. Jawa from hell.
So looking through his filmography, knowing his films as well as I do, he's way more concerned about how cool things look and how messy they look than he is about making sense.
Oh, he has no interest whatsoever in spoon-feeding his audience. And I think that goes a... two great links as to who his audience is made up of, because you know, I mean, there's certain people that know and appreciate his films, certain types of person. I firmly believe that, but yeah, he has no problem leaving things open ended or not fully explaining things, and I think it's just the way he likes it. I mean, his last film, he's working on some new stuff, but his last film, John Dies at the End, you have to watch that movie 2-3 times before you really start to get everything.
Well, it was visually stunning, but I felt like it was fucking... And I've got the novel, but I haven't read it. Mm. But I felt like it was Swiss cheesed as far as the story goes. I watched that movie and was like, I don't think that was even a quarter of what that book was. Because the biggest criticism I have over John Dies at the End is it set up a cool-ass world and then didn't spend any time in it.
Right.
By the time it was done setting up the world, the movie was over.
Yeah. Well, and I wonder, I mean, like, I'd almost love to see a sequel come back to that world, you know?
Well, a lot of times with worlds like that that are so complex, the sequels are better than the first movie because they don't...
Phantasm and then Phantasm 2.
They don't have to bother with the world building. World building's done. Like I think, in a lot of ways, Tim Burton's Batman Returns is a way superior movie to Batman because it doesn't have to tell you the backstory of Batman.
Yeah, and that's a backstory I am so done hearing. We've heard it so many times and seen it so many times.
We get to spend...
Who doesn't know the backstory of Batman at this point?
We get to spend so much time with the Penguin and Catwoman and...
oh, it's so well done.
Max, what is his name? Max,
Jack Palance's character? No, he died in the first movie. Max.
He's Christopher Walken's character.
Oh, yeah.
Remember.
The corporate guy, yeah.
Remember,
yeah.
This is Christopher Walken, Michelle Pfeiffer, and Danny DeVito.
Well, Christopher Walken was Michelle Pfeiffer's boss. He was like the corporate CEO. Yeah. Michelle Pfeiffer was beautifully cast.
Oh, my God.
They did an outstanding job with her makeup and costume.
I don't think they'll ever be a better Catwoman.
Yeah, don't even bring up Halle Berry.
Other girl, the newest one from The Dark Knight Rises. I thought that was
Hathaway.
I thought that was a throwaway character.
Yeah, I mean
you got to go all the way back. You got to go all the way back to Julie. What's her
name? The 66 TV series. Yeah,
you got to go all the way back to her to rival.
Yeah,
Michelle Pfeiffer.
Yeah, I kind of like what they're doing with the character, or a lot of the characters actually in Gotham, but we won't get into that because we'll
spend a lot of time. Catwoman's a 12-year-old girl, so let's leave that for...
Well, they're starting the whole universe over. It's like an alternate world with Gotham.
I saw a trailer for it that had Bruce Wayne kicking ass.
Yeah.
He's like...
But which Bruce Wayne is it? Grown. So you haven't been watching the show.
Oh, is there
two? I'm not going to spoil anything for you, but you need to go back and watch it. I think it's worthwhile.
I just noticed that the actor's growing up.
Yeah.
He's getting to
the Outside point. Of Flash, I think it's the only DC television series worth watching.
Yeah.
Because I know a lot of people love Smallville and Green Arrow.
I
didn't like
Smallville, but I love... Yeah. Excuse me. I loved Lex Luthor, the guy that played Lex Luthor in
Smallville.
Smallville. I thought he was a great... I like him as an actor, but I thought he was spot on for... I think Kevin Spacey and him are the two best...
Kevin Spacey was cool. You didn't like Gene Hackman?
Gene Hackman's good.
He was awesome.
But I don't think... He was just being Gene Hackman.
Yeah.
He wasn't being Lex Luthor. He was just being Gene Hackman.
For that movie, he was awesome. But in general, he would not have been the best choice for Lex Luthor.
But Gene Hackman.
Right.
If you're going to make Gene Hackman a villain, he's going to be a bad motherfucker.
That's true.
I just don't think he was the best embodiment of Lex Luthor.
No, because the whole movie was kind of silly anyway. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah, I thought Kevin Spacey did a great job. And because it was Kevin Spacey playing Gene Hackman.
As
it was a Gene Hackman impression. Yes. Which I don't think a lot of people picked up on, but I picked up on it.
Well, sort of like how Jesse Eisenberg played Jesse Eisenberg doing Lex Luthor, you know.
Oh, yeah, I didn't even talk about him. He's definitely not a good Lex Luthor. But he's not supposed to be Lex Luthor. He's supposed to be Lex Luthor Jr. Lex Luthor's dead.
Whatever, I'm so done with DC movies.
They didn't do a good job of explaining that. I mean, they had him stand in front of a giant picture and say, my dad's dead, but...
Honestly, the only reason I'll be seeing Wonder Woman opening weekend is because my wife's dying to see it. I'm so done with DC.
That's one that I'm not... I'm looking forward to... I'm looking forward to Justice League. I think Justice League will be a fun movie, but I'm not going to go see Wonder Woman. It's just not for me. It's not made for me.
I'm honestly not necessarily looking forward to either one, but I'm going to go in open-minded, hoping
for
the best.
This movie that we're talking about, Beastmaster, actually, I was thinking about this today, has a great example of a strong female character that maintains her femininity throughout the entire film.
Yep.
Whereas this Wonder Woman character is just, like I was ranting about Logan. You could turn, if Wonder Woman was male, it would be an Arnold Schwarzenegger masculine, like it's just masculine women, and I have no, I am not interested in more masculine women lead movies. Yeah. Make them feminine again, man. They can kick ass. The girl in this movie kicks a bunch of ass.
Well, how do you feel? Since we're already, how do you feel? I'm just playing devil's advocate here. How is it you're seeing the Wonder Woman in this new movie coming up is not feminine?
Because she just beats people up.
That's what Wonder Woman does, though.
Wonder Woman isn't a feminine character. Wonder Woman is a masculine character.
Yeah.
The character itself is not meant to be feminine. The character itself is meant to be a masculine female. I'm not criticizing it for the source material. I'm criticizing the source material.
Oh, okay.
Wonder Woman has never been a character that I've been drawn to. I'm drawn to strong feminine characters.
Okay.
And I argue that both Ripley... and Sarah Connor are feminine characters
that are forced to do manly things. I got you.
And that's why they're...
Whereas Wonder Woman, that's all she's ever known. That's what she was made for.
She's just a masculine character.
Right, I got you.
She's full of testosterone and beating people up.
I'm picking up...
Whereas Ripley, what is one of the first things Ripley does in Aliens? She finds Newt and protects her like a mother through the whole movie. Her concern is for the child through the whole movie. All the way to the end, she's making sure... that Newt is taken care of.
And all for naught.
And she has to fight. Well, a lot of people are saying that's not continuity anymore. Right. It's not canon. But yeah, her survival instinct and her attacking the Queen Alien and everything she does in that movie is to protect a child.
Yep.
That's feminine.
Yep.
Just violence isn't masculine. A particular type of violence is masculine. Her violence came from a nurturing protection, protect the nest kind of thing. And so did Sarah Connor's. And Sarah Connor, the reason she's such a strong character in Terminator 2 is because she's forced to take on the masculine role. She builds her body up to the strength of a man because there's no man to protect her son. And she's constantly fighting between nurturing John too much, and she even says so in the dialogue.
Right.
How can I not protect him when he's the savior of the world? Mm-hmm. How can I not let him become his own man? He's the savior of the world.
Right.
She's caught between nurturing her son and letting him. The father says the masculine role is, I don't care that you hurt yourself. Try again.
Mm-hmm.
You have to do this yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do this with my help. If I keep doing it for you,
I'm not gonna
you'll
be
never
forever.
Become a man, and one day I won't be here to do it
right.
for you. The mother's instinct is completely different. The way Ripley treats Newt,
mm-hmm.
she never says, Newt, do this for yourself because I won't be
just
around.
Just stay close, hold
she
on,
says,
and stay behind me, I'll protect you.
Let
right?
me protect you. That's feminine.
Right.
Masculine is, I'm going to beat stuff up,
right.
but you're going to have to beat it up for yourself at some point.
Yeah.
And that's the way, so whenever I say that Wonder Woman is just another in a long string of masculine female movies, they don't understand.
Well, I mean, when you think about it,
they're pushing females as strong leads, but they've lost the concept of what a strong feminine lead is.
Yeah.
They want strong masculine.
I guess in the long and short of it, I mean, this is a prime time that they would have finally gone through and made the Wonder Woman movie given the world we live in today.
Absolutely.
Because, I mean, when you think about it, when that character was originally written, it was back at a time when it was a male-driven society, and, you know, we're going to create this female character for the women, yet it's going to be written basically like a man.
Again.
Yeah. You know?
Which is why James Cameron wrote such a brilliant script in Aliens.
Yeah.
He wrote one of the biggest, craziest action movies of the era and put a feminine lead.
Mm-hmm.
Not a female lead, mm-hmm. a feminine lead. Mm-hmm. We as dudes were like, fuck yeah, save that kid. We didn't care that we, and again, and
most guys, most of us guys into this stuff that are worth our salt are more than happy to see a strong, well-written female lead because you don't see it very often. We get tired of watching, you know, hulked out men that can't act in the lead roles all the time, you know? We're not looking for more Arnold Schwarzeneggers. We want something different, you know? But yeah, I mean, Kiri, played by Tanya Roberts in this movie, in The Beastmaster, she doesn't do a lot of action and stuff on her own, but she doesn't just fall in and do the typical sorcery
stuff.
She
throws punches and she knows where secret passages are.
Even when they first meet, he's all doing the typical.
He's very chauvinistic in his approach.
She doesn't fall for it.
He tricks her with the tiger.
Mm-hmm.
She immediately turns the tables on him, but she doesn't do so in a masculine way.
No,
she does so with her guile and cunning, femininely.
Absolutely.
And again, that's that's somehow lost on writers in Hollywood today. They forgot how to write feminine, like sexy, strong women.
Because so little of the Hollywood. So little of the writing coming out of Hollywood today is original.
So what else has she done?
So Tanya Roberts? Most recently people probably remember her as Donna's mom from that 70s show. This role in Beastmaster actually ended up getting her the role as Stacy Sutton in A View to a Kill, the 1985 James Bond film.
As the Bond girl?
Yeah. There is a movie, not so much anymore, but that had... This is what... Sheena was a movie, I would say, at one point had cult status, and that's kind of fallen off. But she was the lead in that film.
Oh, yeah.
She's done a lot of TV. I mean, sadly, I mean, for her age, she's still a good-looking woman, if you've watched the 70s show.
She's fucking sexy. Sexy
as milk. But as she's gotten older, she's kind of... Her career has kind of been... subjugated to primarily television work. I'm just looking real quick. The most recent film that she did of any note.
Her most recent credit as an actress is 2005, so she hasn't done anything in a long time.
Yeah. She was born in 1955. But yeah.
She's hanging
a lot of different TV work, but
she's hanging it up. She's made it a career.
Yeah, honestly, the last major movie that probably most people have heard of was A View to a Kill. And then there was, of course, a lot of like late 80s, early 90s stuff with titles like Body Slam, Purgatory, Twisted Justice, Night Eyes.
She was in Silk Stockings.
Yeah, exactly. That kind of fair, you know, Skinamax type movies.
Yeah.
But, you know, she did perfectly fine in The Beastmaster, I thought. She's not an Academy Award level actress or anything, but...
Nobody is in this movie. Like I said, this isn't a dialogue-heavy movie.
Except maybe Rip Torn, but not in this movie.
Well, for what it is, for what it's worth, there's only a few real monologues in this movie, and they are delivered by John Amos and Rip Torn. Those are the two actors that really carry this movie dialogue-wise. Oh, yeah. But it's not a dialogue movie. This is a movie about monsters and weird shit. So let's talk about... let's talk about Mark Singer, because this is the dude, right? He's the Beastmaster.
This is the dude, yep.
This is the Beastmaster. And he's probably most well-known... What is he most well-known for? Is he most well-known for V?
I'd say that's probably... outside of the Beastmaster, that's probably what most people think of him from. I'm just thinking here. Now, he actually had a little cameo role in one episode of the 2011 TV series that when they tried to bring him back, which didn't go over real well.
I didn't watch that. Was it any good?
It was, the production value was better, because if you go back and watch V, you know, there's some cool parts, but for the most part,
he came back for the
effects are dated.
He came back for the Beastmaster TV show too. It looks like he has no shame when it comes to. Now, I didn't watch the Beastmaster show, but you know what was awful? I think
the two sequels.
Yeah, well, I don't. The third one, I don't remember being
the Eye of Braxis.
Isn't that one like shot on video?
It was really, really bad. They were both pretty.
Not just direct to video, but wasn't it shot on video?
It might have been.
But the Beastmaster 2.
Now the portal of time. Time traveling Beastmaster.
Now there is a there's a special place in my heart for the worst sequels of all time. What are the worst sequels of all time? Let's give me a couple. Give me a couple that you can think of off the top of your head.
Oh man!
Absolute worst sequels of all time. I'll start you off. Highlander 2: The Quickening.
Oh, absolutely! Because it completely disregards the first movie.
Probably
entirely.
The worst sequel of all time, because it tries to turn it into a futuristic space alien race.
Right.
When it was clear that this was a spiritual, the Highlanders were it was a spiritual thing. It had nothing. Which is why churches were the no go zone. For fights, like it was very, very much like a religious, spiritual thing that the Highlanders would steal each other's souls. Like they were literally,
and they were aliens now. All of a sudden, instead of ancient immortal humans,
so a movie has to really fucking shit the bed to be in that group. And another one that I can think of off the top of my head is the sequel to Saturday Night Fever.
Oh, Staying Alive.
Staying Alive, directed by Sylvester Stallone. Really fucking big step down. But it doesn't change the continuity the way The Quickening does. But Beastmaster 2 has always been in there for me. Because doesn't Rip Torn even come back? I'm opening
he
it up now.
He might have.
Maybe it's a different villain. I remember the villain was a piece of shit. And it's literally like, let's take Beastmaster and put him in L.A.
Mark Singer actually did an episode of the Highlander series, too.
That's cool.
Yeah, but I mean, again, a lot of his work was relegated to smaller...
I guess Wings Hauser is probably the villain. From that movie.
But yeah, and just... In all fairness, Don Coscarelli had absolutely no involvement on either the sequels or the TV series.
Don't jump to conclusions there, buddy.
What do you mean?
Don Coscarelli was the writer. Oh, no, it's based on
characters. No, he had some
based
writing,
on characters.
Yeah.
Based
yeah,
on characters.
Come on
okay,
now.
Okay, okay, okay.
Let's not put
words in the. I saw him in the credits here on IMDb. That's what I get for going to the internet. That's what I get for going to the internet. So Mark Singer.
Yes.
I'm sorry, not Mark Singer. Mark Singer. Who am I thinking of? Who's the... Brian Singer. He's the X-Men guy. I thought I called out the X-Men guy for a second.
And the Superman Returns.
He's very beautiful. He's a very pretty man. He's got his...
He's got his
whole chest and back
that
waxed.
That is actually something that was... Okay, so let's talk about that for a second. He's actually pretty well ripped. And Coscarelli talked about how hard he worked out to get in shape for this movie. And... Other than Schwarzenegger, when we're moving forward a few years with the Conan... Well, actually, Conan came out...
Same year.
It was like 3 months, either before or after.
We're going to talk a lot about that when we get into the story.
But Conan was already looking like that. That was his thing, right? But other than Conan, the Sword and Sorcerer movies didn't typically go out of their way to have big, muscly guys as their leads.
Deathstalker did, but that was probably an answer to Schwarzenegger later on. I don't remember what
Deathstalker was. Let's back up. I finally thought of one that was a horrible sequel. The Fly 2.
I love the fly too. Are you kidding? We get to see what the fly looks like in its full transformation.
But I mean, as a sequel.
No, it's... that movie is hyper violent and crazy. And that thing at the end where he turns the fucking bad guy into a fucking. Into what? We're gonna have to do a double feature episode. Yeah, we'll compare them because The Fly is one of my favorite movies. One of my favorite movies of all time. But listen, I love that sequel. I love it. There's a shot where he pukes on a guy's face, and the camera comes back, they do a couple quick shots of the fly running away, and the guys running up, and like the army guys are like the guard guys, like the security guys, run up, and the guy with no face is now just a red skull, but he's still breathing.
Yeah,
it's got his chest going. That fucking freaked me out as a little kid, because in movies when you get stabbed or shot, you fall over dead.
Right.
There's very little like agony.
There's no death scene. It's like, oh, okay.
There's very little agony that goes on in film deaths. Mm-hmm. That was a agonizing death, and that was one of the first agonizing deaths I can remember seeing as a kid, where I was like, oh my god, he's still alive, he has no eyes, he has no face, and he's fucking still breathing.
Yeah, I need to go back and watch it. I mean, I'm tempted to agree with you on the effects work.
Half the movie is the little kid.
Yeah.
And those security guards are cruel to him.
Yeah.
When he grows up and becomes the fly, he gets his revenge on the security. I think it's a great movie.
I need to go back and watch it. I just remember seeing it as a sequel and being sorely disappointed from a story perspective.
I guess it's no...
But no, the effects work is great. I'll give you that.
I guess it's definitely no Jeff Goldblum. The guy that they got to play him is no Jeff Goldblum, but it's his kid. Like, it's a direct sequel. It's supposed to be the
Run
son...
Run the Fly Jr.
Yeah, it's supposed to be the son of... what is his name? I know Brundle is the last name.
I don't remember his first name. I'd have to look it up.
Seth
Brundle. Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah, I need to revisit that. We'll maybe do a fly double feature one episode.
So Mark Singer was awesome in V. V is fucking underrated. And it looks like he was in V Everything. Because V was a TV miniseries, and then it was V The Final Battle miniseries. And then it started as a TV miniseries. Right.
The Final Battle was a TV movie, wasn't it?
It started as a TV miniseries, then did a TV... Well, The Final Battle had three episodes, so it was also a miniseries. And then there was a full-blown TV series that went 19 episodes. And he's in all of it, man. He plays Mike Donovan in across the whole thing, so that's pretty cool.
Because he was in a segment of the Twilight Zone movie. And he did some other stuff. He was in Body Chemistry. He did some things. This and the V franchise is probably the two biggest things he's known for. I used to always get him and Mark Hamill mixed up.
That'd be easy to do. Yeah.
Yeah, they're both Marks. They don't spell it the same. They have that similar kind of look, But
so let's dig into our heavy.
Okay, get into the numbers.
No.
Or what?
Our heavy? You know what heavy means?
You're talking about me again.
What heavy means in this... No! What heavy means in storytelling, the villain.
Oh, absolutely. All right, thank you. I got a little story to start off with Mr. Rip Torn. All right, first of all, actually, I love Rip Torn. Just because that's his real fucking name. And it sounds like a totally fucking made-up name. I mean, how cool is that? You got brownie points right there. But when he was approached by Coscarelli to take on this role, he had read the script already, and he came to Coscarelli with ideas in mind already, and he said basically, and I paraphrase, but essentially, he said, I want to play this role like a turkey vulture. And I just put myself in the shoes of Don Coscarelli, and went, how does Don Coscarelli react to that?
What the fuck did you just say? You say, do it, whatever, man.
But think of Max, the character, right? And what's the most, other than his Vulcan eyebrows, what's the most standout feature of him?
I don't know, his fucking nose.
His big beak hooked nose, right? Yeah. That was a prosthetic, obviously.
Was it?
It was entirely Rip Torn's idea.
He wanted a big ass beak.
He wanted, well, if you go back and look at it, looks like a fucking beak for a turkey vulture.
He wanted to play it like a turkey vulture.
But now, it's, he's a strange, an odd duck for sure, I think. But it was great though. It's like the added makeup just added to it. But he really captured sort of that. I think he did a better job on some level as that, like, evil occult villain leader guy than James Earl Jones did.
Oh, he definitely did. You know? James Earl Jones. James Earl Jones, like, phones it in.
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't look like... He's like, I'm Darth Vader, motherfucker! Yeah, he doesn't look like he gives a fuck. This character's fully integrated into this world. I don't see... Well, probably has a lot to do with the nose, but I don't see Rip Torn. I see this cultist.
Absolutely.
And,
He conveys that. It just has that look like, oh, this is a creepy cult motherfucker. And he'll do some nasty shit. And he is. He is obsessed with killing kids.
He fucking loves killing kids.
I think he's like a serial killing pedophile, and this is just his
for
cover.
Because there's a scene where the Beastmaster has the kid saved, and he's like,
yeah, he has it's a golden eagle, is the bird.
Yeah.
He has a golden eagle go by. And doesn't hold up the best effects wise, but it's 1982. Come on. And in fact, in a commentary on one of the, I think it was the Bubba Hotep DVD commentary, Coscarelli even says, you know, people need to cut us some slack because 1982, there's no fucking CGI.
Well, again, I think that's a testament to how good the movie looks. That people don't realize it was that early.
But yeah, so he's sacrificing this kid. He pushed him down into the fire. The kid's hanging on, trying not to fall. And so Beastmaster sends the eagle to go swoop down and pick the kid up, fly away with the kid. So what does Mass do? He's a fucking spin master. He goes to the people and says, see, the gods want you to sacrifice your children.
He just absolutely wants to kill everybody's kids.
Rolls with it.
He wants to kill everybody's kids. And is there ever, for a movie all about magic and monsters, does this dude's god ever show up?
Nah.
This dude's murking kids left and right, and I can't remember any point in the movie where, I mean, his...
Because his god's not even real. Well, the king doesn't even believe in the same religion as he does.
But all his witches and everything, their magic all works.
Yeah.
It's not a world without magic. It is a world with magic, and this guy murks the fuck out of kids for a god that never...
Basically a god that says, here's some fucking magic, do with it what you will. I'm going to sit back with popcorn and see what you monkeys do with it.
Because in these types of movies, you almost always manifest the god at the end. And it's almost always like, possesses the body of...
But I don't think that's what it was about for Coscarelli. I think Coscarelli was more interested in the interplay of the characters.
Well, he was interested in a lot of things. Let's get into it. Let's start with the... anything else to say about Rip Torn?
No, I mean, we'll just say whatever else we got for while we're going through the story. But
so, let's do the numbers.
Numbers? Okay. Rotten Tomatoes, we keep coming back to this, but whatever. Habit is whatever. It's 42%, which I can see that. Can you go back and watch the movie again? Each time I watch it as an adult now, I realize it's kind of a slow movie. It's got kind of a slow...
It's two hours long.
Yeah, it's entertaining.
It goes on, like, after the whole... After he fucking vanquishes the cult leader, there's a whole other villain he has to fight from the beginning of the movie.
Long, and it is slowly paced, but it's not boring. But I tried to get my boys to watch it, and they got bored in the first 30 minutes. I'm going, man, says a lot about attention span from when we were kids and kids today.
Well, the first 30 minutes is very much like the first 30 minutes of all these movies, isn't it?
Yep.
Let's talk about the numbers a little bit more.
Oh, yeah. So, had an estimated budget of $8 million. Okay, so remember, this is his first movie with more than a budget over $1 million. So he went from hundreds of thousands of dollars he was working with previously on a movie, less than a million. Now all of a sudden he's got an $8 million budget. So I think he did, in 1982, I think he did a pretty good job with the money. I mean, when you consider the fact that it's pre-digital, you know, but you don't have the kind of budget to really go all out on practical effects. Opening weekend, he did $2.9
million. Well, that's not bad.
No. Domestic gross, $14 million. So it's nearly doubled.
It's a moneymaker.
Yep. Distributed by MGM, so he had a big studio behind him.
Played a lot on TV.
So, and this is one of the things. This is the one movie he made with and for studio, and the reason he hasn't gone back and done that, because as much as people love this movie, and even though it wasn't a financial hit, it had moderate success financially in the box office, and then developed a cult following over time. But even though it's got a cult following, and it's very popular, now... Coscarelli is not happy with the film because there's a lot of things that he wasn't able to do because it was a studio film and they were just constantly getting in the way. So, I mean, I think that says a lot for Cusarelli, too, in that, you know, he's having to fight off the studio at every turn.
Do you have
and
any,
still creates a movie like this.
Do you have any examples of that, like what they were trying to push
and
on?
You know, I tried to find somebody. He hasn't, that I found, he hasn't talked in great detail in terms of the specifics. I think a lot of it is just creative control of various types. And then plus you've got the fact that he's worked with all these animals. There's lots of stories. There's stories out there about the issues with the animals. I don't know if you want me to get into that now or we'll get to the numbers first. We'll come back to that. Mm-hmm. But so like the scene where Beastmaster's still a boy, and it's actually a scene where he first realizes he has an ability of some sort with the bear.
With the bear, yeah.
Well, that was it was a Russian bear, and the animal trainer that was responsible for bringing that bear was the original animal trainer. Apparently, when they first brought that bear out to do the initial take, the animal trainer lost control. The bear basically injured the trainer, and all the cast and crew went running for cover.
Wow.
And obviously, you know, that trainer was canned, and they got a new trainer to come in. It's actually a tiger, a regular striped tiger that they used, because Don Coscarelli wanted a black leopard, because that's what the script called for. But the trainer said black leopards are typically skittish and hard to work with, so he decided to go with a tiger, a traditional tiger, which is much easier to work with. But he didn't like the stripes, so they actually dyed the tiger black. But it was apparently a weak dye, in that it kept fading, and every time the tiger would be given a drink, they'd have to re-dye his muzzle. So, like, in the movie, there's varying degrees of darkness of the tiger, especially the muzzle area. You'll notice there's specific times where it looks lighter or gray or even almost white at times.
Yeah.
So there's that to deal with. Then you got ferrets who apparently are not trainable. They have 20-plus ferrets on set.
Wow.
To do these shots. And most of the time, they had to, like, coax them with food to get them to go a certain direction or whatever. Then you got the golden eagle, who shows up with virtually no training, who was actually on loan from an animal park owned by the San Diego Zoo. And this golden eagle wouldn't even fly on cue, to the point where they actually had to lift it up by hot air balloon into a special basket.
You have to fly a bird.
They had to airlift this eagle with a hot air balloon in the special basket with a trap door. And when they got it up to about 300 feet where they wanted, remote control opened the trapdoor, dropped the eagle to where it would have to fly, and then they capture their shot.
Wow.
And so you can see, this is just with the animals, the headaches that poor Don Coscarelli had to deal with making this movie.
Wow.
On top of that, remember, hardly anybody has any clothes on at all, right? And it looks like a very warm climate.
Hardly anybody.
Well, this is an area of California at a time of year, apparently, where it's a little more mountainous, and it's actually quite chilly out there most of the time. So you have the actors running for cover to get warmed up between each take, which is going to slow your production day out down even more. The infamous scene where we first meet Tanya Roberts, and she's in the pond. By the way, the waterfall that goes into that pond was not actually there. They had to bring water in to create that waterfall. And the water was so cold that it was very uncomfortable. And you can tell when she first get out, because she's on point, so to speak. We'll put it that way. But supposedly, if you slow it down frame by frame, you can actually capture the grimacing look on her face of discomfort as she's getting out of the water.
Wow.
But I mean, just imagine just like, you know, probably, you know, just really cold water.
So this wasn't the most fun.
This was not the most fun production, though.
What else you got with numbers?
Okay, so it was originally released August 20th in 1982. Released in a total of 1,061 theaters. Opening weekend, it was ranked number 4, so not bad. Especially when I read the films I'm about to read to you that opened with it, or that were playing along with it on opening weekend. So, no fault of their own, who can compete? Number one that weekend was E.T. the Extraterrestrial.
Oh, yeah.
No qualms there.
And I only know this because I went to a live screening. Do you know what opened the following weekend?
What?
John Carpenter's The Thing.
Oh, okay. Yeah, there you go.
And it bombed.
Yeah, that's another movie that did not open that great, but developed a big following. So, number two, Friday the 13th. Let's see your Friday the 13th knowledge. Do you know which one that would have been? Which part?
82?
Yeah.
Somewhere between 3 and 5.
No, part 3. Yeah. That was number 2 in the box office that weekend. Then, kind of romantic drama, I guess you'd call it, Officer and a Gentleman, number three. And then number four is The Beastmaster, followed by The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas.
What an eclectic week.
Right. Followed, number six was The Road Warrior.
Wow, okay. That opened, or it was just in the
just that weekend. This is the only film that opened that weekend.
Road Warrior and Beastmaster. We could have
everything else
see,
was already playing.
We
yeah.
could have gone to see a double
that would have been
feature.
A good double feature.
Oh, man.
Followed by Fast Times at Ridgemont High. Followed at number eight by the Star Wars reissue.
Wow.
Number nine was The World According to Garp, which I think is a great film.
That is a great Robin Williams film.
Yeah. And then always a little obscure, and then a little obscure film at number ten called Young Doctor.
World
in
According
Love.
To Garp. What happens? He loses a kid. There's a wreck at the end of the movie where his kid dies and his wife's giving a guy a blowjob that gets castrated. And there's an awkward scene later where he visits her, she visits him in the hospital. And like, I miss our kid, I miss him too. Let's have another one, okay. This is a weird movie. Weird movie. I'll never forget that movie.
Man. So yeah, that rounds out the 10. So, you know, honestly, if it wasn't for E.T. opening that weekend, this film could have done a lot better. I think E.T. obviously would have drawn a lot out of that, but I don't think, without having seen this ahead of time, I don't think the average person would have guessed Beastmaster would have done this well.
No, definitely not.
Yeah.
Definitely not.
But numbers-wise, I think that's about all I got on this one. It's one of those middle-ground films. It wasn't a flop, but it wasn't a financial success either.
I remember it played on a lot of TV. I first saw it TV.
Oh, yeah. That is one thing I wanted to touch on is... so, there's a little bit of an urban legend with this movie, although it's more fact than legend. But this movie, Beastmaster, got so much play on cable TV that for today, even to some extent, but that's carried on today, TBS and HBO played it so much that they ended up giving them a little play on words. Is TBS became known as the Beastmaster station, and HBO became, hey, Beastmaster is on. But it's so true, man. This movie played all the time. And even on channel, because my wife growing up as a kid, they never had cable. They just had regular TV, antenna TV. And that's how she saw it. And I'm like, well, how do you see it? Because TBS is basic cable. She said, Channel 11, man. Yeah. And you know as well as I do, Channel 11, at least what it was then. It's not, now it's the CW or whatever. But
oh, it was great when we were kids. They played
all sorts of good stuff.
Shoot out of good movies.
That just means this was the first time she watched it with me. I was like, oh, this is the first time you got to see it commercial free, isn't it? She said, yeah.
Wow. Any other numbers?
No, that's all I got for numbers, man.
So this movie, and I understand why it plays out this way, but it was cracking me up watching it.
Mm-hmm.
This movie can be described thusly. Mm-hmm. This is the sword and sorcery movie where the guy from V stands around and watches a lot of people die.
Yeah.
Now, I understand why. Mm-hmm. Because Don Coscarelli wanted to tell this story visually.
Mm-hmm.
So in order for him to visually show that Rip Torn sacrifices babies... Mm-hmm. He's got to go ahead and kill one first.
Right.
In order for Don Coscarelli to show that the owl, fleshy bat creatures absorb humans by wrapping their wings around them, he's got to kill one first.
Yep.
He's got to do that. In order to show the slaves being turned into berserkers, you got to show the worm
going
into
the... But that's fine. I'd rather him show us than he tell us everything through dialogue, you know?
But what it creates is it ends up being Beastmaster himself that stands around and watches so much of this happen. So Beastmaster watches a guy get mauled to death by a bear. He watches a child be sacrificed before he jumps in and tries to stop the second
one. Well, with all fairness, he was a kid still during the bear scene.
It doesn't matter. He watches as the man is being transformed into the berserker, and then there's one right near the end that he watches someone get murked, and it was cracking me up because it just kept happening. It happened again. It was like four or five times. The scene is Beastmaster watches person A die in order to save person B.
He's a reluctant hero.
He doesn't care about that first person in any of these scenes. But again, I get
can't
it.
Can't save them all, Kevin.
I get it that that it's Don Coscarelli trying to visually show things, but it's one of those instances where it's like show versus tell isn't always the strongest. Sometimes that'll hurt your story if you keep going back to that same well over and over again of having your main character observe atrocities before stepping in.
But how, like, especially with the Falcon people, as I call them, because I don't know, they don't have names that we know of. I mean, how do you really have an understanding of what these things are, or what they can do without showing it, you know?
But, again, it's just the same character just watching, just observing it happen over and over again.
Well,
you can show these things happen,
yeah.
But to just have Beastmaster be the one, and he's your hero. Right. He's your guy that's trying to stop the nefarious plot from unfolding, and yet he spends a lot of time just observing people die.
He does. I don't know, I have less of a problem with it than you do, I think, because and there's so much that he does visually in terms of foreshadowing and storytelling. Like, with, you know, at the end of the first scene with the Falcon people, they give him a medallion.
Can we stay on that for a minute? Can we stay on the Falcon people?
Yeah.
Why are they homies?
What that?
Why in the world are they homies?
Well, do you remember, or are you just asking me to tell you?
I'm asking you to tell
me. Okay. Because initially, you know, even at the end, he's still scared to death of them. Beastmaster is not like these guys. He's
but
like,
they love him. Falcon dude gives him the nod.
Well, the reason is because he is the Beastmaster, and it's not so much they understand that, but they understand he has a very distinct bond and connection with this eagle. And eagles, or birds, I'm assuming birds of any kind, but this eagle in particular will say, they see that as a god. It's like their god.
The eagle is the god of the Falcon people?
Right, because if you remember,
they don't have beaks. They have like venous.
As they're slowly moving in on Beastmaster, his eagle friend swoops in, lands on his arm, and then he puts his arm up. He goes and stands on that black hawk or eagle sculpture that they worship.
Okay.
And so then they back off because they're like, holy shit.
Okay.
This is our god, and he's friends with our god, so he's our friend.
Okay.
You know? And so then he's still like, these people fucking creep me out. So he's backing away with his sword ready, and then he turns, and there's one standing right in front of him, and then he goes to close his arm wingy things, his trash bag wings. And he's thinking he's toast, but really they put this medallion on a chain on his sword, and it slides down. It's this big, bulky metal, like, hawk medallion that looks like the statue they worship.
Right.
Well, he's like, okay, thanks. What do I do with this? Well, it's not until later on he realizes, oh, maybe this is, like, a sign of friendship, like, you ever need our help. So, you want me to jump forward then?
Yeah.
Come full circle? So, once again, they're trapped. It's him and Seth, right, is the John Amos's name?
I guess so.
The Pilgrim?
Yeah.
I think that's his name. And one, I don't remember the third character, but there's three of them that are surrounded by the Jun soldiers from the Jun Horde. And they're thinking they're done, but he had, prior to that, remembered he had the medallion, so he gave the medallion to his eagle and told his eagle to fly off. And we don't know what's happening. I mean, you could read into it at that point that he's going off, but what happens is, just in the nick of time, as they're about to get slaughtered, these Falcon people, stealthy-like, ninja-like, swoop down and land behind the Jun.
They look more like flying squirrels than falcons.
We'll get back to it. Just let me finish this, come full circle
first. They don't have any feathers.
And then they basically attack from behind the Jun Horde to where they can come back and win. So they kind of, you know, helped out. Now, the Falcon people themselves, yeah. When I first saw them, I'm like, what the hell are these people? So if you look at their heads, they kind of look like eagle heads without beaks.
They don't have beaks. Okay. They don't have feathers.
But they got like bird-like nostril slits.
What is that?
There's a very vague, abstract, minimalist sort of a bird look to them, minus the beaks.
You can't have a bird without a beak.
And they got the sort of semi-bat wing thing going on.
Like flying squirrels?
Nobody said they're falcon people. They look like ball sacks. For some reason they worship.
They look like ball sacks between their arms and legs.
And they, for some reason they were, I mean, he didn't explain it to us, but is it necessary that we be given that detail? This is just what is in this world, you know? I mean, that's the way I look at it, but, and then, the, you know, when he first comes across their little camp, And he sees the cauldron. He's poking around the cauldron, and then the severed head pops up. He's like, "Oh, what the fuck?" You know. And then, but then when they trap you in their wings and they squeeze you or whatever, I don't know that they're really sucking on you.
I don't know what the fuck.
They're squeezing. Doing. They're like compressing you, and then what happens is all your insides come out, hit the ground as like a green goop, and then when they release, you're like a burnt out porcelain shell that crashes on the ground. It's weird and gross and cool, but why? I don't know. Are they eating you, or is that just how they kill you? And if they're eating you, then why do they need the cauldron of body parts, you know? I don't know. It's definitely weird shit that he doesn't fully explain, but I would almost hate it if he tried to fully explain it. Then it would be like a George Lucas midichlorian explanation. I hate that shit where you feel like you gotta spoon feed every little detail. Leave some stuff up to the imagination.
Next question.
Okay, bring it up.
Beastmaster is the unborn child.
No. He was born.
The main character. They keep calling him the unborn.
Right. Well, he was...
Rip Torn calls him the unborn.
Right, and they're referring to the fact that he was never born from a human.
He's the... Well, the prophecy is the unborn son of... The king, Zed. Right. Is it Zed or Zeb?
The bear's the mark, Zed. We'll like kill Zed's you. Dead, babe.
We'll kill you.
Yeah.
This is the basically carbon copy plot from Willow.
Mm. Well, but this kind of thing pops up a lot in the child will kill you. Sorcery stuff.
The villain's like, fuck that, I'll kill the kid. And then they take off with the kid.
But he never did kill the kid.
They don't kill the kid in Willow either.
That's true.
So here's the plot. Mm-hmm. Unborn son of Zed, or is it Zeb?
Zed, Z-E-D, like the number.
Unborn son of Zed is going to kill you. Fuck that, I'm going to kill him first. Whereas in Willow, they just run the baby out, put it in a basket, and Willow finds it. They do this fucking this
witchcraft
cool
teleportation.
Ritual, this cool witchcraft ritual where this witch creeps into the king's quarters and lays this glowing blue liquid across.
You know what they use for that?
What?
It was actually just the liquid from the glow sticks.
That's awesome. And it paralyzes the king and the queen.
Yeah.
And they're awake and they're seeing this happen, but they can't do anything about it. And this witch brings a cow in to the room and transports the baby
magic teleportation
from the womb from the queen's womb. Into the womb of the cow, and then teleports with the cow out to the wilderness, then cuts the baby out of the cow, brands it, and goes to
and
kill it.
And that's when his adoptive father finds him and kills the witch, which is actually a great scene.
Which is just an old guy with a cool weapon.
Right.
He's got some weird boomerang.
Which basically, Krull came after this, so I won't say it's copying Krull. You'd have to say almost Krull's copying him, this movie, to some extent. But,
well, one of the best parts about these sword and sorcery movies is the weaponry.
Oh, yeah.
And this movie does not skimp on the
weaponry. There's actually a funny story about that. Dar, which is the name of the Beastmaster, Dar's sword was highly sought after by the cast and crew of this film, and there was a running joke throughout the production of the film who was going to end up going home with the sword. Well, nobody ended up going home because during post-production, apparently someone stole the sword, and it's still not been recovered, and apparently there's supposedly still a nice reward being offered for the Sword of Dar.
Well, I haven't got to my question yet.
Okay.
So they take off with the unborn son. Mm-hmm. And what is the cult leader's name? Rip Torn?
Mayax.
Mayax is pissed. Mm-hmm. We fast forward a bunch of years, and Beastmaster is now the guy from V. Mm-hmm. As he marches through this story, he encounters a girl. Mm-hmm. He encounters a pilgrim
and his
with
son.
A little boy.
Well, yeah. At first, you think it's a son, but it's just a boy that's with
why
him.
Would it be his son? The pilgrim's son?
Well, until you know, why wouldn't it be?
Because the pilgrim's black and the kid's white.
So what does that matter?
Because the black guy can't have a white kid.
He could have adopted him.
Well.
That's
again, my reaction now, watching it, is Beastmaster encounters a big black dude walking with a little kid.
Yeah.
And they claim they're religious. mm-hmm. and they stick very close together. Uh-huh. And I'm wondering to myself, is this a very close relationship? How close is this?
Well, you know who the kid is.
But
right?
you only then later on find out that the kid is actually his little brother. Mm-hmm. He's the latest child of mm-hmm. the king and queen. Is the girl not related to him? Is
no, that
not
his sister? Actually, it's funny you bring that up because it turns out Kiri is his cousin.
I was going to say
Coscarelli has actually related. Commented that they knew this was an issue with the script, but they never really fully addressed it. So you got a little bit of a you got a little bit of a Luke Skywalker Leia Empire Strikes Back
issue. It shoots way past that because they're making out hardcore at the end of the movie, and I'm like, aren't these people related?
Well, this is a different time, different place.
That was my question.
Yeah, but they are technically
Here's
related.
My other question.
If you follow the family tree.
Next question. Mm-hmm. At the end of the movie, why do they keep referring to his little brother as the king?
Because he's the heir to the throne. Because
why wouldn't he be? He's the
firstborn.
He's the firstborn.
I understand. Just hear me out. Up until his return, they pretty much assumed he was dead.
And now that little kid better be trying to find ways to kill him because he just got usurped from his throne by the genetic firstborn.
Unless Beastmaster renounced the throne and said he didn't want it.
Which he did.
Right.
He does.
So there you go.
But even then, as that's happening, mm-hmm. is there a little bit of dialogue there between him and John Amos? Because it seems to me like John Amos is like, no, this is the king, motherfucker. Yeah, you go fuck yourself.
Not a lot. I don't think he wanted it, though. I think
he didn't want it.
Yeah.
But I don't think... I guess what I'm saying is there wasn't really any point where anybody in the movie said, it's yours. He just
again,
said...
He
took it upon himself to be like, and by the way, you know, it is mine, but, but you know, you're going to make a great king. Isn't that just the dialogue like, you're going to make a great king, and
it's
goes to take off,
yeah,
and the kid's like,
minimal.
Please don't leave me. And he's like,
it is very minimal.
I got my cousin to fuck. You get out of here.
It is... It is very minimal, but again, I'm okay with that because you figure it out, you get it, and you're not being spoon-fed. You're not being treated like you're an idiot, and I appreciate that, you know? All
right.
But yeah, it's something what it is it's the connection, it's Kiri's connection that you don't necessarily get at first, and then when you do, you go, wait a minute.
Next question.
Okay, bring it on.
Would you say, conservatively, 20 years have passed since he was unborn and ran off with his adoptive father. So there's 20 years between the beginning of the movie and when
he was... I'd say he was 12-ish, probably. 12 to 14 when the bear incident occurs. So...
You're trying to put him up to 14. He wasn't 14.
Nah, I wouldn't say he was less than 12, though.
I'd put him around 12. Let's say he was 12.
Let's just say 12, then.
Okay. And how old is he?
So that would put him 32...
So 10
he
years.
He might look it, but I'm...
10 years.
Yeah.
10
I'm
years.
Not thinking that's a 32-year-old.
Not 20 years. Let's say, conservatively, 10 years.
So
10 years, 10 years have passed.
Yeah, 10 to 15. Yeah.
You want to go 15? 15 years have passed.
Mm-hmm.
He's in his early to mid-20s.
Mm-hmm.
When his father is brutally murdered, mm-hmm. he is attacked by a bat-headed...
God, they didn't even give him, like, a cool death. Like, he was trying to be honorable, but man, he didn't even get a strike in. It's like, that's one thing that bothered me. It's like, his adopted dad was cool.
He also watched
honorable.
His dad die. So
yeah, he watched his dad die, too.
He watched a bear kill someone, he watched his dad die.
Why couldn't they let his dad at least kill one of these djinn motherfuckers before he gets taken down, you know?
This whole movie is just Beastmaster watching people die.
A whole lot of people
he
die.
Saves a minimal amount of people.
Yeah.
There are more people
the film
that die.
Also doesn't pass the doggy snuff film either.
Oh, I forgot
either.
To say that.
It doesn't pass the doggy snuff
that
film.
That dog
test
gets
either.
Away.
But the dog dies an honorable fucking death.
Dog does get an honorable death. But this film does not pass the doggy snuff test.
No, it
does
not. So fair warning to everyone.
Next question.
Mm-hmm.
Bathead guy that swoops into town and kills his family.
Yeah, the Jun leader.
15 years later,
mm-hmm.
at the end of the movie, after Rip Torn has been vanquished,
mm-hmm.
he comes back.
Right.
Wearing the exact same outfit from 15 years ago. That mm-hmm. motherfucker is hanging on to fashion. Why does he look exactly the same? Everybody else, they did a decent job of aging him. Even the Rip Torn character looks
aged. Well, we never see
aged.
His face.
He's exactly the same.
No,
they
I
took
hear
him
you.
From one scene and put
I
him
hear,
in the next.
I hear
and 15
you.
Years is supposed to... They didn't change the way they looked or dressed for 15 years?
Well,
that dude really liked that mask.
Yeah.
He's been wearing that mask for 15 years.
That may be his thing. Screws his slave wenches in that mask.
Are they his cousins?
Maybe. If Trent is anything in this movie.
All right. What's your favorite scene in Beastmaster?
Before we go down that road, I want to touch on one other thing that I probably should have brought up during the numbers, but it's not a numbers thing, but I think it's important to know to set this film in the right time and place. Kevin, what is this movie rated?
Oh, we talked about this. This movie in Kevin world would definitely, for the time, but I don't think they had it. They didn't have PG-13.
No, just having seen the movie, what would you rate it?
But they, I rated PG-13, but yeah, they didn't have that.
They didn't have that. And this is the point I'm trying to make. PG is what this film is rated. PG in 1982 is not the same thing as PG
is now. Monsters, is slugs and ears, is naked tits.
And not just one pair of naked tits, but at least two different pairs of naked tits. And not just, whoop, oh, did I blink? Did I see? No, it's like, especially with Tony Roberts, it's like, hello.
Gratuitous titties.
Somebody's cold and somebody else is awake, you know? I mean,
PG, but they only had PG in R. Or did they have G also?
Well, they had G and then they had X, but because that was kind of a carryover from the late 70s.
Right, but
nobody ever got that. I mean,
nobody got X because that was because they actually played pornos in theaters.
Well, but it wasn't strictly meant just for pornos. But there was only a couple of films that actually got...
There were very few films that got X for one.
Midnight Cowboy got released initially with an X.
But that was for sexual content, not for violence.
Right, right. But that's what I'm getting at. Is it's so bass-ackwards because, look, Coscarelli specifically has said that him and Paul Pepperman, who's the co-writer on this, that they worked together... This is the fourth film they worked together on. If you notice, there's never any blood scene on Darth's sword. For all the killing he does, for all the killing anybody does, there's no blood.
Yeah, there's actually one of the last shots up on the whatever the altar, the pyramid altar. Mm. Darth slaying everybody, and then there's a shot where it's like the last cultist, and he like flips around and does the whole "I'm gonna fucking stab you backwards" kind of thing. Totally see it's just on the other side. There's no blood.
But there's no blood anywhere in the movie except maybe you could kind of make the argument when they stab the burning stick into the eye ring, you know, but it's real dark. The fluid is real dark.
There's blood.
And then there's the green goo, but I mean, it's very minimal, and they did that intentionally because they, all along, they wanted it to get a PG rating so the kids could see it. And then they turn around and put
all them titties in
all the titties in the movie, which is going to guarantee you get the adolescent boy and teen boy audience, but I just find it so funny. And it's very much different today. I mean, I don't know. It's not the opposite. It's just very different today. It's like PG. It's got to be like G-level stuff for it to get a PG rating. And then now, with horror films, there's this big... All the studios want to be PG-13 so they get the kid audience, which they're not supposed to be attracting anyway, right? And so they're all shooting for PG-13, but now you've got comic book movies are going, oh, with the success of Deadpool, let's go into our territory because that makes us money. Everybody's all fucked up right now.
But there's a documentary about it called "This Movie's Not Rated."
It talks all about this.
It's all about how subjective
and the inconsistency of it and everything. It's
super subjective.
The ratings are really kind of a joke, and always have been from the
get-go. And even Trey Parker and Matt Stone talk about how they released the South Park movie.
Yeah.
They got notes from the MPAA to get it down to an R rating, or was it a PG-13 rating?
No, I'm pretty sure South Park was R rated, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, because there's so much cussing and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Well, the last set of notes they sent them, they just sent the movie back. They didn't make any cuts and they approved it.
Well, I've heard a couple of different directors at this point on different podcasts and commentaries talk about how there's this little thing that a lot of directors do that they don't talk a lot about, where they'll actually shoot certain scenes and things in mind when they make the film to where they have more than they actually want, but so that when they get the infamous notes back, they've got something they can cut out and then still ultimately end up with what they want. So it's like padding the film, knowing that they're going to be asked to cut certain stuff to get the rating they want. Yeah, so with that side note, you were asking what's my favorite scene? That was the question was initially. I really like, despite all your questions, I really like that initial.
Despite all your questions, you always take it whenever I ask these bizarre questions about these movies.
I really like how.
Hang on. When I ask these bizarre questions, it doesn't mean I don't like this. This is maybe my favorite sword and sorcery movie. Question mark.
Technically, we both love the film, but technically, this one ended up being your pick. So I get you. I know you love this movie. I know you got mad love. But no, I really like how Coscarelli did. As simple as it was, I really like how he did. How he portrayed Dar's communication with the animals. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't just the eagle. He did it with the tiger, too, mm-hmm. where sort of the eye vision is what I always call it, because it's like this tunnel vision, but it's shaped like an eyeball.
Yeah. And he does the POV of the tiger.
And it's funny. My youngest son, I caught him yesterday after having seen this movie, and we were at the park, and some friends were there with their dog, and the dog was a little anxious and skittish, and it was a big dog. It's a pit bull, but it's like he was kind of like nervous and not taking it easy. So I look over and I see my youngest son. He's sitting Indian style on the ground, and he's kind of doing this. And at first I'm like, "What are you meditating?" And then everybody's, "No, he's trying to fucking communicate with the dog because he thinks he's the Beastmaster."
That's awesome.
I thought that was really cool the way he did that. And then I thought the pyramid production was cool, and another number I left out earlier, but the pyramid itself cost $52,000 just to create that pyramid, with the fucking steep ass steps of insanity. Holy which, by the way, they had a really hard time with the stuntmen.
I'm sure.
They didn't want to volunteer to do all these fucking falls during the battle scenes down these steep ass steps on the pyramid. But no, that was impressive. And I think some of the wider shots, I couldn't tell. It almost looked like they had a model built that they used for some of the wider, long shots that featured like the pyramid and the town around it. It kind of looked like it was a, you know, how they take the forced perspective with the model in the background. But I couldn't tell for sure, and I haven't been able to find anything to confirm that. But what's your favorite scene?
Well, before I talk about that, I have to talk about an issue with nature that I thought as a little kid was going to be a much bigger deal in my adult life.
Mm-hmm.
There's two things from 80s movies that made me think were going to be really big problems once I got out into the world myself,
mm-hmm.
that turned out to not be real things at all.
Okay.
Well, not necessarily not real things, but not real dangers for anybody mm-hmm. in the urban setting. The first thing is roaming bands of street punks from all the movies set in big cities.
Yeah, where are all the street gangs at?
They're not roaming bands of street punks that have, chains all over themselves.
And bats, spiked bats.
Nose piercings, spiked bats, and big mohawks going around beating people up.
No themed costume gangs.
They didn't even really beat people up for money in those movies. They just beat people up to beat them up. They're just roaming bands of street gangs, street punks. The other thing was quicksand. And we meet our ferret characters when Dar goes jumping after they've stolen his belt while he's trying to bathe, and he goes leaping after.
Right.
He goes leaping after the ferrets and ends up in the quicksand, uh-huh. and ends up having to talk him into fucking dragging him out of the quicksand.
And then one of them falls in. And then as he's catching his breath, you're sitting there watching, you're thinking, is he not going to save the little fucking ferret? And you realize he's catching his breath, and then he finally realizes it and digs him out. So here's what I just thought of this, and I didn't. I closed my laptop here, so you know I'm not cheating. I actually do know this by heart, and it's my litmus test to see how big of a fan you are of the movie. Because I am a big fan of this movie, have been for years. What are the names of the ferrets?
God, I don't remember.
Podo and Kodo.
Podo and Kodo.
Yes.
And the ferrets live.
One of them does.
That's right. One of them sacrifices himself
into
to kill
the fire to save because Max is about to backstab Beastmaster, and instead he jumps on him, bites at his neck and his face, and they both fall into the fire. But who survives him? Remember, as they're walking down the steps of the pyramid,
is it
you got the one. Surviving ferret that pops his head out of the sack.
Yeah.
Then what happens?
I don't know.
Like two or three little baby ferrets pop
their heads out. Oh, of course. They have to turn her and hooch it. You can't kill the ferret without bringing in the cycle.
So this movie also doesn't pass the ferret snuff film test.
Wow. This movie is violent to animals for being the Beastmaster.
Lots of animals and people dying in this movie.
So my favorite scene is definitely the creation of the berserker.
Oh, yeah.
And the berserker chasing the ferrets.
Yeah, that would probably be my other favorite scene.
The whole, I guess, the siege of
the... Well, no, walking through the hall with all the berserkers and...
Yeah, very, very cool scene.
That's cool.
And then I love the hawks, but I've already talked enough crap on the hawks. Yeah. I don't think I get to call that one.
Remember the brutal kill scene where the two berserkers get it under the big gate?
That comes down. That's one of those things where it like hurts you when you see it. Because they slide under and the thing comes down.
Okay, you remember Dirty Dozen?
Yeah.
And there's a scene where it's the, I forget his name, but it's the black character. And I pulled Kevin.
I pulled Kevin.
But and they're trying to get across the bridge, and then the one post holding the bridge up breaks. And so he's holding it, but it's like gutting him at the same time. He's like, and that is his final scene. Because he's like, it's like, you guys go ahead without me. You know, it always reminds me of that because I had the same gut reaction. Ha, let's see what I did there. when I watched that movie, because it's like, oh, that just looks so painful, you know. I got quite a bit of this. It didn't come into us talking about the movie story-wise. Lots of fun trivia to share. I don't know if you want to go into that or if you got anything else you want to talk about first.
No, I'm done. I'm ready to wrap it up. So just throw a couple of them at us. And
yeah.
We've overstayed our welcome.
So producer Dino De Laurentiis, who's responsible for making this movie happen, actually offered Coscarelli to direct Conan the Destroyer in 1984, but Coscarelli actually declined because he said the script was dumb.
See, I have to go back and watch that one. I don't remember that one being bad, but people always like criticize that one. They say Conan the Barbarian's great.
It's lots of fun.
Is really bad.
Yeah.
And I remember, isn't there a giant snake in it? Isn't there all kinds of
things? It's not a snake. It's like a weird horned, like, dragon thing.
And is that the one where he gets the Zimbabwe sidekick? Is that the
chick? You mean Grace Jones?
Yeah. Is she in that one or is she in the first one?
See, that's the thing. I always get Destroyer and Barbarian mixed up.
Yeah, I can't remember what happened.
Because they're very much the same movie, just different characters and different circumstances.
Yeah.
But I can never keep the two straight in terms of what happens in which movie, and I need to go back and watch. That needs to be another double feature.
Yeah.
So we can, for once and for all, differentiate
the two. Put Conan the Destroyer in its proper place to suck.
So Kiri, let's talk about Kiri for a second. Tanya Roberts was not the first choice. Originally, an 18-year-old Demi Moore auditioned several times for the part of Kiri.
Wow.
And although she was Coscarelli's favorite choice, again, here's the producers fucking with his production, his creative control.
Dino said, fuck that?
Dino said, no, I don't care if you want Demi Moore. We're going with Tanya Roberts.
To be fair, if you're at a point in your career where the producer that you get to argue with is Dino, how do you say his last name?
De Laurentiis.
Yeah, Dino De Laurentiis. He's like one of the biggest, heaviest producers of all time. Mm-hmm. He's produced almost all of the movies. So for him to, he's one of those producers where it's like, the producer really came in there. It's like, yeah, he's also a bad motherfucker. And he knows how to make great movies. So. Yeah. Let's let him, maybe, Don, maybe you ought to let this dude do his work, his magic. Because as you were saying that, as you were like, oh, it was a troubled production, and he didn't like it because the producer had too much control. It's like, there are a lot of movies that you can tell.
Yeah.
The story in this movie is very clear.
Oh, yeah.
This movie is
told. Despite all that, he still managed to make a very watchable movie.
Yeah, this movie isn't like a hodgepodge of scenes that don't make sense. And even the few holes I tried to find here, you were able to, I just wasn't paying close enough attention.
Yeah.
They were very.
And that'll come with repeat viewings, too, I mean. But yeah, while we're talking about Kiri, apparently in the original script, Kiri dies.
Oh, wow.
But.
Makes more sense than making out with your cousin at the
end. But a good point. But that was one of the conditions of financing for the film, is that her character had to live in the end.
That's weird.
Yeah, that is
so weird. Was that Dino again?
Probably.
She was probably sucking his dick. She was probably sucking his dick. All right, give me one more.
One more, and this is probably my favorite bit of trivia because it's a holy what the fuck moment. Don Coscarelli's original choice. Again, Don Coscarelli's choice had it happened. Although this is you can put this back to the producer technically in a roundabout way. Don Coscarelli's original choice to play the villain, Mayax, was not Rip Torn, but was in fact Klaus Kinski. I understand not everyone's going to know who that is. He was perhaps one of Werner Herzog's best friends, and he's fucking psycho, which is probably why Werner Herzog was best friends with him. But if you've never seen A Gear Wrath of God, amongst many other things, there's a horror film called Crawl Space. But see Aguirre, Wrath of God, and then if you really want to, Fitzcarraldo. He's a German actor, stellar actor, just amazing, but always plays some sort of nutso. But they couldn't come to an agreement because apparently Klaus Kinski wanted too much, and they couldn't come to an agreement on salary, which is where I would tie in producer.
And he didn't want to play a chicken vulture or whatever.
Turkey vulture. But I'm just thinking, like, Rip Torn was good, but imagine if Klaus Kinski was Mayax.
I don't know. You sold me on him early when you said he wanted to be a turkey vulture. Right. And asked for a prosthetic nose. I mean, I'm cool. Crazy. I'm very comfortable. Like I said, everything that you're saying, like, Dino's choices seem to be the right choices.
Yeah, I mean, they seem to work out fine.
I don't have a problem.
I mean, we'll just have to wonder and imagine how it would have been otherwise, but... I mean, I don't think it really hurt the film any.
I'm not one of those guys that always is on the side of the director.
No.
A producer with as much clout as Dino has is... Because if you go look up his resume, he's fucking produced everything.
Well, it's curious because I think you would say, obviously, Demi Moore had a more successful career.
Maybe not if she had been in Beastmaster.
Exactly, right. But, but at the same time, Tanya Roberts got her biggest role as a result of Beastmaster. It's just she didn't do shit after that.
Right. All right, let's do 6 degrees, yeah. And we're done.
And once again, I'm waiting for the day that I get stumped. It hasn't happened yet. I'm not tooting my own horn. I'm just as surprised as everyone else. So, 6 degrees of Fred Dekker connecting him to the Beastmaster.
How many degrees did you do it in?
I did it in 5. So what I do is I go by the film titles.
Right.
Since we're connected to a film. So starting with Beastmaster, going backwards, forwards, whatever you want to call it. So Beastmaster, 1982, stars Rip Torn, as we discussed, as the very enigmatic, very cool Max. Rip Torn also was in a movie from 1985 called Summer Rental, comedy starring John Larroquette, amongst other people. John Larroquette also starred in a movie from 1982 again, called Cat People, okay? Which was a...
He was also Dan on Night Court.
Yes, he was. in Cat People, that movie also starred an actor that's been around a lot. I guess you could say character actor, Ed Begley Jr., okay? Ed Begley Jr. was in the Roseanne Barr film She-Devil from 1989.
That's a rough one.
Which also stars Linda Hunt. And do you know who Linda Hunt is? You'd know if you saw her. She's a little mousy, big, round, glass hair. Like, yeah. And Linda Hunt starred in If Looks Could Kill, or was in If Looks Could Kill, 1991, which, again, as we always come full circle in the end here, because there's the list of official credits for Fred Dekker isn't very long, but he's very influential, which is why we love him so much. Which was, the story was written by Fred Dekker. So in 5 degrees, I've connected Beastmaster to Fred Dekker.
Fantastic, sir. Fantastic. All right. What's on deck?
Next week. Oh, Kevin, next week. You thought this week was fun, folks. Strangers, Kevin and I are tackling Killer Clowns from Outer Space next week.
Fantastic. Lots to talk about with that film. Yeah. Can't wait to revisit it. I haven't watched it in years. Not one of my favorite films of all time.
Yeah, I can understand that. But it's one of my most... enjoyable films of all time.
Not one of your favorites?
My favorites list is really long.
You always say that. All
if
right.
We go broadly, yeah, it's one this, of my... Ah, man.
Gang, over on the Patreon. Over on the Patreon, we are giving you a bonus episode of Watching with Strangers every single week for $1. You come in at the $1 level on Patreon. you get to hear us yammer on even longer about current films we've been watching, things we've been checking out on Netflix, things we've been checking out on DVD, things we've been checking out on the internet. And you also get access to all of my audiobooks. Mm-hmm. Audiobook that just finished up was Cotton Candy, my weird wear teddy bear cannibalistic orgy gangbang book. You can listen to all my audiobooks on Patreon at that $1 level. It's not $1 per episode. It's not $1 per audiobook. It's $1 access to all of this. So come on over to the Patreon, drop us a buck, get all this additional content, and we will see you for Killer Clowns from Outer Space next week. Gang, keep
watching.
All music heard on the Watching with Strangers podcast, courtesy of Kevin MacLeod at Incompetech.com. Licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0, http://creativecommons.org/license/by/3.0/.